I wanted to talk a little bit about the Daniel Mellor situation and some things that crossed my mind as I was sitting in that context. I did have Daniel, and he was one of my leads in the five plays I did over at Chess. And then he and I used to go with Josh Martin and Baxter. We used to go hang out Burger King or Arby's. And I was thinking a little bit about Daniel and some of the things that were said. I agree with you. Some of the things that the pastor mentioned in particular on that. During that memorial service on Thursday, I was thinking about, you know, your mind wanders a little bit when something tragic happens. I know Wednesday we were talking with Dr. Borkert, and there was a young man, tragically, who also died. He was a resident, right? Resident podiatrist over there at NCMC. And he had horrifying tragedy hit him. He became paraplegic, and then from there, death, kind of unexpectedly. And when death sneaks up on you, I suppose, in the sense that it's not something you anticipate, it's not something where you feel like, I feel like I've gone to so many what I consider to be young people's funerals recently and or been exposed to that. And your mind wanders a little, and you think, God, I guess I don't completely understand what's happening here. I'm confused by some of this. And there's a part of your heart, part of your soul that is so lost in the face of this type of stuff. And you think, God, this is wrong. I mean, that's the only word you can really sort of settle into. This is wrong. And that's true, right? That's true. This is wrong. It's not the way it was meant to be. And you can just tell that this is wrong. It's not what we were built for. It's not what was supposed to happen as part of God's design. And that longing, that sense of anxiousness, that sort of that thirst for something better grows. The more you see the tragedy, the more you encounter this stuff, you realize, God, there has got to be better. There has to be, and I know there is, and I trust in that better. And that was the thing that kind of caught my attention, and partly it was because I was thinking to the portion of scripture that we're going to read together this morning, and we're going to talk for just a few minutes about. I want to think about thirst for a moment, but not the kind of thirst. I mean, we start with thirst in the sense of our desire for water. And we have a lot of medical folk, but the good news about the desire for water is that it is not something that only a doctor understands. It's kind of a universal sort of a thing. You're like, I am thirsty. I mean, it doesn't really take a degree in medicine to understand the principle of thirst. It's an experience we all share in. I need water. And the longer you go without it, the more you recognize there's an urgency to this. And the longer that goes, you start to think, I am desperate and I would kill for water. I mean, it's amazing how much our body craves water when it needs it. And Jesus used an illustration in the passage that we're going to read this morning, and he describes himself. And remember, in John, the thing that John wants us to do is what? What is John asking us to do with his description of Jesus? What is he writing this to accomplish? I don't mind waiting, it's good. To demonstrate, to conclusively declare that Jesus is equal to God. He is God, absolutely, the divinity of Christ. Good. So that's sort of the objective truth claim. Jesus is God. Awesome. Is there more, or is that I don't mean that question in a weird way, like, well, there should be more than that, but that's the truth, right? So what's the impact of that? Does he tell us how that applies? Jesus is God. Good. Okay? What else?
So because Jesus is God, by believing in him, we can have life.
Because Jesus is God, by believing in him, Jesus, we can find life in his name. We can be included into life that is in God. That is a claim that is monumental. That is the heart of the gospel in many ways. That's the piece of the thing that we all recognize when we come to faith in Jesus. We say, I Because I believe objectively that Jesus is who he claims to be, that he did what he said he did, and that it accomplished what he claimed it would accomplish, I am now part of the equation, right? This matters to me on an individual level. This matters to me. This changes things. And that's the piece for me that I was, I don't want to say surprised by, because I already knew this, but that's the thing that if you read John enough, you start getting slapped by the fact that there should be a difference in me because of that truth. And this is something that we fight against every day. This is something we fight against. I've fought against my whole tradition, all growing up and all throughout my churching life, is the challenge of taking what is true about that, the objective truth of the fact that Jesus is God, and saying, and because of that, I now change. I now am part of something big that should have an impact in my life. And again, we struggle so much with this because we have this tendency. We've talked about it last week with the illustration of the mason jars and all these other things. We have a tendency to put something useful on a shelf and look at it. We take this truth and we say, it's beautiful, it's lovely, and I enjoy it, and I praise God for it. And it's amazing to think that we could praise God for something as powerful as life in Christ and yet never touch it, never make that part of who we are. It's astounding to me that's possible, and even more than that, it's astounding to me how often that's true for me. And this passage tells us a little bit about that. So the story we're going to read now is in John chapter 6. No, it's not. It's in John chapter 7. And we're going to talk from verse about 14 or so through about 39. So we talked already last time, 2 weeks ago, a little bit about some of the response that Jesus had to these individuals that were challenging his claims. Now again, remember, the thing that's interesting about this portion here is that there's a lot of disagreement, a lot of argument, because the Jews that are in this place, and in this case in particular from about chapter 6 all the way through maybe chapter 9-ish or 10, Jesus is teaching in the temple, right? He's in this space which is very familiar. There are plenty of folks who have grown up in that tradition, so this is a very traditional space, right? I mean, if you don't think so, you're silly, because you had requirements, ridiculous requirements, to get into this space in order to be part of the tradition that was there. And it was a very key part of your history, was to participate in a very traditional way in this area. So Jesus comes, and during the Feast of the Tabernacles here, he's participating in sort of this festivity that celebrates what God had accomplished for the nation of Israel. And he's taking all this stuff that was set up to memorialize their walk through the desert and their move into the promised land. And he says, this is about me, and this is about me, and this is about me, and this is about me. And I am all the point of all that you're doing. And there's a part of that that makes people's heart get a little bit fluttery, right? You're thinking, whoa, you're telling me that our entire temple tradition that's been our experience for thousands of years was about you? Who are you, right? Who are you? And that question is a legitimate question for them to ask. In fact, that's the point, is to ask that question. Well, who would claim such a thing? To suggest that every part of all of Scripture and all of history and all of our worship in the temple is pointed to you is a pretty scary reality if it's true. And if it's not true, then it's pretty scary that you would claim such a thing, because that is blasphemous, right? So this is rocking everybody there as they're hearing this radical teaching, this authoritative radical teaching that is saying the whole point of all of history, all of time, all of creation, all of your tradition is me. And there are those that grab stones at that thought and think there is no way that a dude from Galilee could make such a claim. There is no way that is appropriate. And they are angered by that. And we've talked about how that impacts all kinds of different things. So this time we're going to talk about this next portion. Now remember, one of the things that we've said is that this truth that is presented by Jesus automatically causes division. This big truth that we looked at last time. Because absolute truth naturally demands exclusive allegiance, Jesus inevitably causes division. Because absolute truth causes or demands exclusive allegiance, if it's absolute, it can only be truth, then it automatically creates this division, this divide where people have to make a call about what they are hearing. I have to decide. If I agree with it, then I'm all in. Not part in, but all in. And if I don't, then I'm all out. Not mostly out. There's some good pieces here. And that's the thing that's interesting. We talked about this just at the very end last time. The fact that there are lots of people that would like to take a little of truth. A little of truth with Jesus. Well, you know, there are some good things about Jesus, and I appreciate portions of what he says. And you know, there are some really good teachings that I can glean from. And in fact, I would make the argument that he is one of the best teachers I know. And there is a lot in our culture that would point to Jesus and say, great teacher, really peaceful man. I mean, he was one of the first people to do sort of the nonviolent protest. We really appreciate his love for the poor. And then they grab all of these little things about Jesus and they sort of say, this is my part of Jesus that I'm good with. And so if you're good with Jesus, well, cool, me too. We can be friends. Okay. But the interesting thing here is that exclusive allegiance is required. If he is true and what he says is true, then my belief in him can't be partial. And this is something C.S. Lewis, there's a portion in Mere Christianity that I looked up because this, and we use this illustration often. This argument that's made about sort of this part of truth that we can engage in, but not the whole thing. It's a little bit of a lengthy section here in Mere Christianity. C.S. Lewis says, I'm trying here to prevent anyone from saying the really foolish thing that people often say about him, speaking of Jesus. I'm ready to accept Jesus as a great moral teacher, but I don't accept his claim to be God. I'm willing to say he's a moral guy, but not God. This is the one thing we must not say. A man who said the sort of things Jesus said would not be a great moral teacher. He would either be a lunatic on the level of a man who says he's a poached egg, or else he would be the devil of hell. Right? It's those two, nothing else. If he's claiming to be God, he's either crazy as a loon, or he's the devil himself. You must make your choice. Either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. And that's the quote that we often pull out of there. You can shut him up for a fool, you can spit at him and kill him as a demon, or you can fall at his feet and call him Lord and God. But let us not come to any patronizing nonsense about him being a great human teacher. He has not left that open to us. He did not intend to. The reality of God being, who Jesus being God, is either all true and exclusively true, and I completely believe that, or he's crazy as a loon and deserves to be ignored and dismissed. Don't go halfway. Now, again, we think, well, in this context, we would never do that. That's silly because we do all the time. I do all the time. Where I say, Jesus, the teachings of Jesus that I comprehend, the ones that are part of my tradition or system that I'm familiar with, those I appreciate and those I'll consume and I'll be part of. But the parts that are hard, the parts that make me change, the parts that ask me to believe something that my heart struggles to believe, those are the parts that I push to the fringe and say, well, I'm not sure. I don't know if that's really what he meant, or I'm not really sure if that's altogether what I believe currently. And then we dismiss with a million platitudes a statement of truth that Jesus made because we're afraid of the implication. And so we do more or less the same thing more often than we'd like to admit. And certainly in Jesus' case, as he's teaching in the temple and as he's working through these principles with the religious leaders and those that are there, they recognize conclusively, clearly, without question, that principle, that either we have to believe him completely or we have to kill him. And you see the division, and it just keeps coming. Everywhere he goes, he makes you choose. Believe me entirely or kill me. You pick. It's astounding. And again, that divisive, that sort of exclusivity, that absolute nature of Jesus is something that our culture is ridiculously allergic to. And our own hearts are struggling with. We say, oh, we don't know if we want this exclusivity. We don't know if we're familiar, if we're comfortable with the intolerance of someone who demands absolute allegiance. But if truth is true, then there's no option. There is no option. And the interesting thing is, even though we say with our mouth and with our minds, we philosophize, in our hearts, we know that that's actually the case. We know it is. And that's the thing that makes us thirsty. This is the thing about our heart that gets thirsty when we encounter this, because people like Daniel, people like Colt, people like myself recognize that there's something they need desperately. They want that truth so bad, and they are so thirsty, they will go to death to find it. They will go to death to find something that satisfies that part of them that knows there's got to be something to quench this soul thirst I have. And Jesus knew that. And he proclaims that here in John. So he's part of this whole system, right? He's part of this principle, or not this principle, this procedure of the ceremony. Let's read the passage and we'll touch on a few things that are connected to this libation ceremony that he's tying into here with this statement that he makes. John chapter 7, we're going to go to verse 14 to 39. My big thought for today, the thing that I want us to sort of settle into as we see, is that the soul of man is thirsty. The soul of man is thirsty and is invited to freely come and drink from Jesus. In him is life and relief from desperate thirst. That's the idea. That's the big concept that we have here. So let's read this and let's sort of draw from this the things that we see here. John 7, 14, and in about the middle of the feast, Jesus went up into the temple and began to teach. And the Jews therefore marveled, saying, how is it that this guy has learning when he has never studied? I mean, isn't that the question, right? There's so many confusing parts of Jesus. So Jesus answered that my teaching is not mine, but him who sent me. If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking from my own authority. The one who speaks on his own authority seeks his own glory, but the one who seeks the glory of him who sent him is true. And in him there is no falsehood. Has not Moses given you the law? Yet none of you keeps the law. Why do you seek to kill me? And the crowd answered, you have a demon. Who is seeking to kill you? And Jesus answered them, I did one work, and you all marvel at it. Moses gave you circumcision, not that it is from Moses, but from the fathers, and you circumcise a man on the Sabbath. If on the Sabbath a man receives circumcision so that the law of Moses may not be broken, are you angry with me because on the Sabbath I made a man's body well? Do not judge by appearance, but judge with right judgment. So let's just take a few pieces out of this one here, because this again sort of provides us with a foundation for the statement that Jesus is about to make in the temple. So the first thing that they're confused by is the fact that he seems to know really well the truth that he's speaking. And they're like, this is astounding. This guy is really well versed in the truth, and he seems to wield it with authority. And it's not really even something where that there's a learning about him. There's an authority. There's a significance about what he's speaking that we can't stand against. Remember shortly here, and this is the part we read 2 weeks ago, where they, you know, the Pharisees send sort of their mall cops to arrest him. And they come back and they're like, we stood in front of him for 30 minutes and we couldn't touch him because this guy speaks like nobody. This guy has authority, and what he says sounds exactly like what it should sound like. It's sensible and it rings true. How are we supposed to argue with this? So there's this sense in which what Jesus is speaking and teaching just lines up perfectly. And why would that be? Why would it be that what Jesus is speaking and what he is teaching fits to the point where they don't really have any motivation or desire to arrest him? Well, common sense would say, because it's true. If it's true, then it won't sound like a lie. It might to your ears at first, but if it's true, it's going to sound true. And he says, my teaching is not mine, but him who sent me, right? If anyone's will is to do God's will, he will know. I love this. This reminded me, as soon as I read this, the first time I read this was connected a little bit with some of what John was speaking. We know. And if your desire is to do the will of God, you can know whether the teaching is from God. There's this fear that tends to sort of circle around us at times. What if I get fooled? What if I'm drawn aside? What if somebody comes with a real compelling argument that ends up faking me out, and I get stumbled up and I trip up and I end up in this great here? Oh man. And so we become afraid. And what does that fear drive us to? What is that fear, that theological fear? Where does it send you? Sorry, what? Silence? Isolation? Yeah. Woo. Scary. Don't talk. Ultimately, where does it send you? Into heresy, into unbelief, into hell. It's true. If you become terrified to the place where you assume that somehow God isn't able to save, then isn't that the thing that keeps you from salvation? God gives you his spirit, and he has promised you, I will guide you into all truth, and you'll know it. Because if your will is to do God's will, then you will know what is true. Later he says, if one seeks the glory of him who sent me is true, you will know it's true. And this is Jesus' point. You can know that what Jesus says is true. You can know this. It's certain. And then he talks, you know, and I find it interesting. He says, hey, you're trying to kill me. And everyone's like, what? this guy is crazy. He must be demon possessed. Who's trying to kill him? I find it so interesting that they imply that, of course, well, that would never happen. That's ridiculous. This guy's crazy. And yet, very shortly, they will do just that, right? They'll kill him. But at this point, he points to the behavior, the things that he has done, the signs that he has done. Remember, the things that Jesus is doing, these miracles and signs, all of the stuff that he's doing is intended to verify for the watcher, for the one who sees, this is true. There's this weird sense that we have at times where we feel like we shouldn't have to like test God or prove it, right? Well, don't test God. Don't test God. Don't do things that challenge your faith. And the fear there, again, I think stems, the motivation from that, again, stems back into that fear where we're like, whoa, you know, you don't want to mess. But God said and demonstrated through Jesus, I love proving I am who I claim to be. He's very satisfied with demonstrating over and over again that he is exactly who he says he is. And it's okay to ask God again, a third and a fourth and a 4,000th time, God, I know I want to believe you and I'm sure I do, but I really need to once again be reminded of your truth, and I want to see ways in which you demonstrate that. And God provides that for those whose will is to know him. And so these signs are showing up and they demonstrate that. And we could talk for a little bit about some of the circumcision. We're going to touch on that in a little bit later, probably next week or the week after. But I want to continue looking here in John 25. So some of the people of Jerusalem therefore said, is not this the man whom they seek to kill? So here's the funny thing, right? Just a second ago, literally like two verses before, they're like, you're crazy. No one's trying to kill you. And then some people in general Jerusalem are like, hey, isn't it the dude we're trying to kill? The contradictions between every person in these environments is so ridiculously familiar to me, because half the time we're like, that's crazy. No one's trying to kill you. And then somebody shows up like, hey, that's the guy they're trying to kill, right? Oh, man, you people. That's me too. Isn't this not the man who they seek to kill? And here he is speaking openly. And they say nothing to him. This guy, they want to kill him. And yet here he is in the middle of their temple, speaking openly, speaking freely with no one saying anything to him. Oh, what gives? And they ask a question that shows up again. Remember, how this is like probably the third time that this question has come up, right? Which infuriates the Pharisees and the religious leaders. Every time this question comes up, they just explode. Remember when the blind man who had his eyes cleared by Jesus comes, is like, wait a minute, I think you guys might be followers of him. Is that what's going on? And here they say, hey, how is it possible that the guy who they claim to want to kill and arrest is speaking openly? Could it possibly be that the authorities really know that this is the Christ? Could it be they know something and they're not just not telling us? They know that they can't speak against him because he is who he claims to be. But we know where this man comes from, and when the Christ appears, no one will know where he comes from. So they're trying to justify in their own head. Maybe he is the Christ. Maybe they know something we don't. Hey, maybe they've changed their minds. Maybe they've invited him to speak because they know he's Christ. But wait a second. And they bring up an argument that's going to show up again. We've already seen it again in a chapter where they say, but it can't be. It can't be. There's no way this can be, because again, we know that, and this is sort of the common knowledge of the day, is that Jesus would just suddenly appear. I mean, the assumption was that Jesus would just sort of poof and he's there. Why did they make that assumption? Because it didn't tell them necessarily, or at least not in ways that they understood exactly where and when and how he would come. You're like, well, Mike, what are you talking about? Haven't you seen, you know, all the Christmas stuff about the prophecy? Absolutely. But remember, we have the advantage of looking backwards and seeing that. They didn't. And certainly it's clear. Everything makes sense when you look back on it. You're like, oh, of course. But at the time, they didn't see that. And I have a feeling, this is just an aside, but I have a feeling we'll have sort of the same emotion when everything that we see in Revelation sort of comes into being. We'll be like, oh man, how in the world did I miss that? That makes so much sense now. Man, and it's a good thing God's in charge and not us, because there's some confusion there. But at this point, the assumption was that Jesus would just suddenly appear. They didn't recognize the fact that there was going to be this whole process of him being born and being grown up. And by the way, why would there be? I mean, he's God. What kind of God would go to the trouble of growing up? I mean, ugh. And you know what? That's true. What kind of God would go to the trouble of growing up? A God who is touched by our infirmity. He is entirely us. He knows what it's like to be three. Oh, that's one I'll talk to my kids later. What? Okay, so they say it doesn't make sense. So Jesus proclaimed, as he taught in the temple, you know me, and you know where I come from. But I have not come from my own accord. He who sent me is true, and you do not know him. Stop right there. He says, look, you do know me. You know about me. You've heard about me. You've seen me. You've encountered me before. And you know some of my story. He who sent me is true, and you do not know him. There is a sense in which the anger in particular that seems to grow around Jesus' teaching stems from the personal attack that Jesus makes often against the religious folk. How many times in John does he say, if you reject me, you've rejected God and you don't even know him? And I'll tell you now, if you want to make a religious person mad, suggest they don't know really God. They don't actually know him. If you want to make me mad, and I'll tell you, I started mad at first at John. I'm like, come on, John, that's not true. And then over time you realize, wow, there's more truth to this than I recognized. But to suggest that I don't know God entirely, or even at all for that matter, makes religious folks very uncomfortable. And the fact is, Jesus is saying, you don't know me because you don't know him. And I am in him. I know him, for I have come from him and he has sent me. So they were seeking to arrest him. Of course they were. Again, he causes division. That's what he does. But no one had laid a hand on him because his hour had not yet come. John does this all the time. This is the fourth time we've seen where John says, but nobody could do anything because it wasn't his time yet. Take heart. You, take heart from that. Why? Why? Why does that give me encouragement? Why should it? Any ideas? You can theorize with me.
There's legitimately nothing that can be done against the plan of God. So if Christ is standing in front of the people who are trying to kill him, saying the things that are inducing them to kill him, there's nothing to fear because it's not him yet. So
wow.
He has the freedom to do what God has called him to do, knowing that God's timing is perfect.
Yep. That is the same freedom we have. That is the same freedom we have. What holds us back is fear. But there's nothing to fear. There is legitimately nothing that can come up against God's plan. So don't be afraid. His hour had not yet come. So he kept teaching the truth. Yet many of these people believed in him. And of course, that's the other thing I appreciate about this. As he's doing the will of the Father, as he's standing by the Spirit where he ought to be, doing what he should do, people recognize and believe in him. And they said, when the Christ appears, will he do more signs than this man has done? This is one of the things that compels them into belief. How are we going to say no to the signs that are being presented? How is it possible that this could not be the Christ? Now remember, these same people who are believing him, it doesn't necessarily mean that it continues. There's a sense in which we've seen this before, and Dana pointed this out when I was in Wisconsin. Those who believed picked up stones. So just because they believed at first, there will be more and more and more things they'll have to believe and receive about Jesus that become more difficult as it moves on. But certainly they're recognizing the truth and they're beginning to believe that. In John 7:32, and the Pharisees heard the crowd muttering these things about him, and the chief priests and the Pharisees sent officers to arrest him. So this is that first part of what we see later. So they hear this stuff, and this doesn't sound like the kind of thing they want going on in their temple. This argumentation back and forth about the validity of his claims. Well, he has to be true. Look what he's doing. Well, I don't know. He comes from Galilee. Yeah, but look at the signs. Don't they line up with what we know in Isaiah? And haven't we seen in Psalms? And oh, but it couldn't be. The leaders would tell if it was true, right? Well, I don't know. Maybe they wouldn't. Maybe they know something and they're keeping it from us. And this whole discussion is murmuring throughout the temple. And the Pharisees and the chief priests hear this and they think, we got to put a lid on this thing. This is getting out of hand. This has got to stop. And so they send officers to arrest him. We can't be seen doing this. We'll send our mall cops to see if we can get him. And Jesus then said, I will be with you for a little longer, and then I'm going to him who sent me. You will seek me, and you will not find me. Where I am going, you cannot come. So this is the first time he says this. He says it a little bit later. This time the Jews say to one another, where does this man intend to go that we will not find him? Does he intend to go to the dispersion among the Greeks and teach the Greeks? So they ask honest questions, because Jesus does this all the time, where he makes a statement without really any explanation per se, and they think, what are you talking about? How is it going to be possible that you go someplace where we can't find you? Later, the chief priests and some of the rulers say that he's going to commit suicide. But in this instance, they think, well, maybe he's thinking about going to the dispersion. So remember, the Jews had been scattered already at this point. Maybe he's intending to go and teach in sort of the outer cities, and we won't be able to find him. What does he mean by saying, you will seek me and will not find me, and where I am, you cannot come? What does he mean by these statements? All right, and Jesus offers no explanation. He lets them wonder. And his disciples ask the same question, right? We remember later they say, and Thomas says, Lord, you've said this so many times. We don't know where you're going. How could we? I am the way, the truth, and the life. No man comes to the Father but by me. But he's drawing them into the question. Verse 37, on the last day of the feast, the great day, Jesus stood up and cried out. So here again we have this picture, this great day picture, this last day of the feast. And I want to give you a little bit of context here. And this comes from one of the books that I have. This is called The Biblical and Historical Background of the Jewish Holidays. And there's an excerpt here. There's this, the ceremony of the water drawing was a jubilant occasion. So this is sort of one of the features that was still included at the time of Jesus. It's no longer currently included in this, the celebration that they have. But at this point, it was still included. There was this jubilant occasion. The Mishnah states, he that has never seen the joy of the ceremony of the water drawing has never in his life seen joy. I mean, they're like, this is a party to end all parties. This is a joyful occasion that would occur. It's sort of the culmination of the celebration of the goodness of God for the Israelites. As the ceremony took place, Levites played lyres, trumpets, harps, cymbals, and other instruments, while other Levites sang. In the temple area, the three golden candlesticks, remember we talked about the light of the world, these things that are like 75 feet high, were lit by young boys climbing tall ladders, and the light from these candlesticks could be seen throughout all of Jerusalem. Respected men of faith danced and sang in front of these candlesticks while carrying burning torches. Remember I told you that this was sort of like a test of manliness, where like if you're a young man and you wanted to prove your devotion, you'd go for the entirety of the night singing just to prove you could, I guess. I kind of felt a little bit like that on Friday when I was doing the field day over at Max's. You know, you're just like, can I make it through the day? Woo, what's up, kids? And by the time I'm done, I'm like, hello, boys. Come on over. I just need you over here. But these guys are trying to prove that they're devoted to this. And it's just this huge celebration. Often they would actually, included in this portion of the celebration, they would go to that portion in Deuteronomy that talks about if you want to bring your tithe to God and buy something you want. They would include that in this portion as well. So if you want to get food or drink or anything to just celebrate before God, often that would happen as part of this. These dudes that were dancing, they say sometimes they would be like jugglers and acrobatics. I mean, in your mind, just imagine an all-out party. And that's what's going on here. And as the ceremony progressed through the night, the priest blew the shofar three times in the manner of the text of Isaiah 12:3. Therefore, with joy, you shall draw water out of the wells of salvation. The evening was characterized by exuberant joy. It was a wonderful occasion that nobody wanted to miss. So this is the context into which Jesus speaks as he stands before them. And he says, he stands up and shouts out. He gets everyone's attention at this party in the middle of the temple as they're going through this ritual of joy, saying that, and as Isaiah says, salvation is drawn from this well. For the nation of Israel, Jesus stands up and he makes a proclamation about himself. Right? That's the context here. If anyone thirsts, let him come to me and drink. Whoever believes in me, as the scripture has said, out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. Now this he said about the Spirit, whom those who believed in him were to receive. For as yet the Spirit had not been given because Jesus was not yet glorified. Jesus points to this moment where they symbolically draw up this water and pour it into a basin. And he says, are you thirsty? Are you thirsty? The reality is that the thirst that our soul has is as real as the thirst our body has. It's as palpable. Our soul thirsts for something it needs desperately. And we said that there is a sense in which, and it's a true sense in which, souls around us are so thirsty. My heart was broken over and over again this last week as I saw thirst, soul thirst. These young guys that want something to fill up the space that's in their heart and soul. And they say, I need something to fill me up because I can't find anything satisfying. I can't find anything that brings me peace. I can't find it. And finally, they come to this place where they think, forget it. It's not there.
why bother? I'm going to quit. I'm just going to quit because there's nothing that meets that need. And Jesus stands in that moment and says, if anyone thirsts, come get a drink. I meet that need freely. In the face of his enemies, he points at them and says, any of you who are currently saying you are from hell, you are a demon, if you thirst, come drink from me. Any of you who think maybe this is the prophet, if you thirst, come drink from me. Any of you that say this could even be the Christ, come drink of my spirit and be filled. And you know what else? Not just for the moment. Because out of his heart will flow rivers of living water. You know what's great about the quenching that comes from the Spirit of God is that it's not possible to exhaust it. It is impossible to come to this place where you can't find more. No circumstance of life, no struggle, no depression, no weakness, no darkness, no fear, none of that can exhaust the supply that the Spirit of God offers to those that drink of him. And Jesus proclaims himself to be that. And we know this is true. We know this is true. How do we know? Because Jesus said earlier, if your will is to know the Father, you'll know this is true. You will taste and you will see that this is true. So what's our call? What's our commission then in this moment? Jesus makes a proclamation, a bold proclamation, that causes those around him to become very squirmy because of the implications of what he's suggesting. But we who are here today, we who gather this expression of the body of Christ here in Milliken, as we come together, we say we want to be proclaimers. We want to be signposts. We want to be demonstrators of what is true. And unfortunately for us, we often mean well, but we forget to drink first. And so we go and we proclaim there's wholeness, there's fullness, there's soul thirst quenching power in God. And then our own life is dry and misses the satisfaction of ourselves drinking from the same place. My type, pastor types, are probably some of the most likely to fall prey to this. At least that's the impression I get if I go to these conferences and as I read these blogs and different things. Partly because there's a sense in which there's a constant pouring to a measure. People say, I need. My soul is thirsty. And you pour. And there's part of you that goes with that. And then you get dry. And after a while, you find yourself wrung, completely empty of that soul thirst quenching power. And for a lot of people that are in that place, they forget how or why they're doing what they're doing. And this is where God's body is essential. And I am grateful. I've been thinking a lot about this too recently. God has put in our context people who insist that they pour into me. Like, you need something because right now you feel kind of dusty. You thirsty? I am. Good. That's your ministry. That is part of the body, right? And that's the value of having more than one person responsible for the Spirit. That's silly. It's not just silly, it's ungodly. And it leads to so much damage to God's church. Dehydration, spiritual dehydration, which caused weakness and death in God's church. So let's not do that. I can say with confidence, last night somebody texted me because we were doing this thing with a bunch of dudes. They're like, dude, is this a good time or should we maybe wait? Do we just need to be with people? That's a really good question.
You know what I mean? Like, that's a really good question. I appreciate that question. Basically, this person is spiritually intuitive enough to say, hey, is this a good time, or do we need to just sort of drink a little? And by God's mercy, because God's church at High Plains has served me in a healthy way, I was able to say, let's do it. I'm okay. I don't know. I didn't know that'd be the truth, but the reality is I felt the Spirit. Because you guys were praying for me and for each other, and it was encouraging to us. So let's go back to our big truth. Let's see if I can find it. Whoops. Oh, that's big, big truth. Let's go to our second big truth. Oh, now I've really done it. Any minute now, we'll get there. There we go. So here's what's true. The soul of man, you, me, and everyone around us are thirsty. We are thirsty. And each one is freely invited to come and drink from Jesus. In Jesus, you find life and relief from your desperate thirst. So, what are you thirsty over? What part of you needs to be filled back up? Where do you find dryness in your spirit? Where do you find yourself desperate, dry, in need of the Spirit? Take that to Jesus and drink deeply. It's free. And bring with others with you who can point you to health. What else? Got a few minutes. What else? Yeah.
I had a question about what you were talking about a little bit earlier about that. Like, having that fear that compels us to, you know, retreat into mm-hmm. what we know is mm-hmm. or what we believe to be true. Mm-hmm. And how that ends in heresy and unbelief. Mm-hmm. But certainly that doesn't start. It doesn't start necessarily in heresy.
That's true.
So what, I guess, is the, what is the remedy for that, or what is the prevention for that? What is the appropriate response? Like, how do we interact with that?
Like, how do we find what is true without and run back to what we know without going into this place of heresy? Is that what you mean?
On the one hand, there you could say, well, I can't do anything, so just chuck it all, because I'm just going to end up in heresy, you know, which obviously isn't the right response.
Right.
And then you can say, well, I only am going to stick with what I know for sure that I know that I know that I know. Mm-hmm. And then that also leads to this desert mm-hmm. that you never grow, you mm-hmm. never have anymore. Mm-hmm. But I guess what's our responsibility? How do we navigate that? Mm-hmm. When, I mean, like I was saying those few weeks ago, the people that said they were believers, that were the mm-hmm. people that we believers and followers of Christ, you know, he says, well, here's a little bit more, and they're just like, I can't accept that. Mm-hmm. And so we would say, okay, they fell away into heresy or apostasy mm-hmm. or whatever you want to call it. But like, what's the remedy?
Yeah. Anybody want to speak to that?
Remembering that it's about having a relationship with God.
Okay.
Jesus Christ. But yeah, it's remembering that it's about knowing God, and I think a lot of it has to do with for me, the answer whenever I'm stuck with stuff is just praying, mm-hmm. going to God. Eventually,
okay.
God moves through prayer. Because mm-hmm. I've been there with the whole, you know, I don't know about this. I don't know what to do in the wrong thing. But more, you know, I'd go back to scripture. But even there, more so is it's just straight up going back to God, praying, talking to Him. Mm-hmm. As I, you know, studied more about whatever it was I was seeking through them.
Mm-hmm.
17. If anyone wills to do God's will, he will know whether the teaching is from God or whether I am speaking from the Holy Spirit. That's exactly what you were saying earlier, Dan. It's choosing to focus on God himself instead of the things he's given or the truth that he's given. When we get focused on what truth is right here instead of who God is, that's where you're going to focus.
Mary? Anybody else? Yeah. That's good. John, are you going to add something? Oh, I heard you say.
I was just curious.
Okay, that's good.
I mean, this thing, I can't answer. But ultimately, it comes down to enough. I mean, it didn't speak up right away because it sounds so trite, but it comes down to loving God more than I love my theology.
Mm-hmm.
I have to be willing to, and not just willing to, but eager to pursue God and not my own picture of who he is. And so when I find out that he is different than what I expect, which I better be finding that out, because my understanding is so limited if I don't find that, I'm not seeing God. When I find out that he's different than I expect, then I follow him and not my theology. And if my goal is knowing God, not having a perfect system, then it's not actually as scary to run into those things that are outside of my comfort zone, because it's not about my comfort. It's about seeing God. And so, I mean, pragmatically, the way that tends to work for me, and I'm not fabulous at this, but when a question arises or something comes up and it's like, whoa, 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 that looks like God, and I don't want that to be God because that's scary. Pragmatically, what that usually looks like is I say, okay, like you talked about, suspend this belief. I don't usually change what I do right away. I don't change my action right away, but I start thinking through this and asking, God, is this really you? And if it is, what does that mean for me? How will that impact my life? And talk to other people that I trust and respect the way that they think, and I hear from them, and then either I come to the conclusion, okay, no, that wasn't actually God, or more often I come to the conclusion, wow, that's God, and he's bigger and more amazing than I thought, and he's scarier than I thought, and he's better than I thought. And now I've got to change my actions, too, to line up with who I understand God to be. And often as you start to change your actions, then you find something else, and you're like, oh my goodness, whoa, is this you, God? And it's a continual process. But it kind of sounds a little trite, but it's so true. You have to love God more than you love your theology. That has to be your goal.
Yeah. I think that's really, those are all incredibly well stated. I like that. I like the whole piece of that, where it's, what do I know from God's word? What do I know from prayer? What do I know from God's people? And what do I know from God's Spirit as he communes with me? And remind yourself that it's growing up into godliness. Growing up is scary. Anybody that hates kids knows that's true. And the first time they stand, they look ridiculous because it's terrifying. And you're like, dude, you're like 2.5 feet off the ground. And you're wearing a diaper. So the chances are you're not going to hurt yourself. But that's a new experience. And so you kind of get a feel for that. And you fall pretty quickly. But you realize after the fact that that's actually possible. So, step into that. Try it again. And then there are some times when you realize that's not possible. I don't actually fly, so when I jump out of my crib, gravity is a thing. And so that's the opposite side of it, right? Where you're like, wow, okay, I think I probably shouldn't do that because I can't actually fly, even though for a moment I thought I might be able to. The reality of my experience and truth and my cast tells me, bad plan, but good to know. What's up, Silas? Sorry.
That struggle between retreating into what I know and accepting something, a new truth, is hard to find the balance.
Yeah.
That's why I say pragmatic. I don't usually change my actions right away until I determine whether or not this is true. But there's a difference between holding to what I know to be true and plugging my ears and saying, I'm only going to accept what I already know. Hold to what you know. When you come up with something new, hold to what you already know. Say, this is what I know to be true of God. And if God proves that to be wrong, then okay, I want him more than I want my understanding. But I do know this right now. This is what I've seen of God. But I know there's more than this, so I want to take this new thing and see if this is actually God too. And that expands what I've done.
Mm-hmm.
So I do both.
Mm-hmm.
I hold to what I already know. I hold to what I've seen of God. And eagerly accept, as terrifying as it is, the reality that God is bigger than my own understanding.
Mm-hmm.
And that as I see new pieces of God, the stuff that I already know is probably going to change as the rest of my perception goes.
Mm-hmm.
So it's both.
It is both.
It's not that I just hold on to what I know and no, I'm not going to do anything else, or anything new comes along, I throw away everything else that I already have. It's both.
Yeah.
It's got to be both.
One final thing I'll add to this too is the idea that, you know, you talk about holding to what you already know. Very frequently what I've known is still true in the face of something new. It just looks different, but it's not actually different. It's just a new expression of something. It goes from walking to running. Forward motion still involves friction and the balance is still the same, but now it's a quicker movement and there's a little bit of different application to running. But it still employs a lot of the same principles of walking. It's just a new expanded version of that. And for much of us spiritually, I think that's the same thing, where it's not so much that I say, well, walking is now no longer going to be my thing. I will run, although some of our kids, it does seem to be that the case. They forget walking and running. But I don't fly, again. So there's a boundary even within that. But the point remains, you take what you knew before and you apply it perhaps in a new way that still encompasses a lot of what you already knew. It just adds to it. We could go on and on, and I know we like doing that, but we better not forever, because then you guys get cranky and all that kind of stuff. So I'm going to do something a little bit different here, too. We were planning on releasing to you guys all the financials and stuff, and I know Keith went to tons of trouble to have that. I have those reports here. Can we do this, since it's almost 12:30, and my plan was to for sure be done by that point? Can I give you these reports? Can you take those home? Can you look them over? Can you examine them? Can you walk through them? And if you have any questions, you can get in touch with myself. You can get in touch with Levi. You can get in touch with Keith. Keith would be a great person. He has all the numbers in his system. So if you're concerned about any of that, and then we'll come together for just a few minutes. That'll even shorten the next time we get together, where we can kind of review. That would be 2016, fiscal 2016, as well as the first quarter of 2017. Not trying to hide anything. If you guys would rather stick around and have a full-blown meeting, we can do that. But I'm kind of getting the impression from a few of your eyes that I would get shot. So let's just give you those reports. You have those. Do go ahead and hold on to those. And I wouldn't really encourage you to just hand that to your neighbor. I mean, you can if you want, I guess, but I don't really know what good it would do them. So hold on to that for yourself. Check that out. If you have any questions, get in touch with myself, Keith, or Ben, or Levi, or Kevin. We'd love to answer some of those questions. Then we'll come together and answer any of those questions in public. Do bring those questions to public so that other people might have the question but don't have the guts to ask. So is that cool? Are we cool with that? Thanks, guys. Appreciate your attention this morning. You did a great job engaging in this. I continue to think this through. Be prayerful this week for, and in particular today, but this week for your body. You're dismissed. Duh.